Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. I have had a lot of caffeine, so buckle up. We got a lot that we're gonna be talking about. It's generally dark stuff. We've got some attacks against peaceful protesters. You know, your standard run-of-the-mill thing in America where we don't have any rights anymore. Later on in the show, we're gonna be talking about trees. So just get ready, it's coming. I know you're on the edge of your tree. But it is important. We're gonna talk about both deforestation and reforestation. And I'm going to make a plea to our president to take nature seriously for once. We've got Ben Shapiro, apologies in advance. But he's attacking workers, and I feel like it's my job to respond to that. But along the way, we also have three awesome guests who are gonna be joining us, more than usual, actually. We've got a congressional candidate from New York who's gonna be breaking down his race in just a little bit, about 10 minutes or so. And then later on, actor James Cromwell and activist and candidate Pramila Malik are gonna be joining us once again on the show to talk about the climate crisis and what sort of pressure we should be putting on politicians on both sides of the aisle to make sure that we do something about our climate breakdown. If we have more time, there has been some breaking news happen, but I don't want to tease that just yet because I'm not sure that it's gonna fit, but we'll see how much we can stuff into this show. But with that, why don't we start off with the attack against the protesters? A really tragic video coming up here. The network of concentration camps that we have in our country remains. The talk about it nationally, you might have noticed, has largely gone away. We've been distracted by other issues, sometimes justifiably. There's been a number of different terror attacks. But the abuse of the people that are being held right now, that continues. And thankfully, there are some activist groups who have been continuing to put pressure on the government on this issue. One of those groups is Never Again Action. It is a group of mostly young, but not exclusively young, Jewish activists who are trying to shut down these detention centers. But understand that they do it not only as sort of like a thankless task where lots of people are not paying attention, but also at risk to their own lives, as is gonna be demonstrated in this video.
When I say justice, you say now. Justice.
Now.
Justice.
Now.
When I say release back, you say kids. Release back.
Kids.
Release back.
Kids.
Whoa.
Probably didn't hear it over the mics, but there was actually an audible gasp in the studio when that person who's apparently an ICE guard decided, you know what, sick of waiting. I'm just gonna drive over these protesters. Sure, they're not threatening me in any way. They're just sitting there. It is the definition of a peaceful protest, but I can't be bothered to wait. I'm just going to run them down. And this was spread on Twitter, both by the group and by the individual who recorded it. So first, this is from Never Again Action, the activist group saying, here is the HD video of an ICE guard driving his truck into us as we sat peacefully blocking the Wyatt Detention Center. We're putting our bodies on the line because we see the camps and the roundups. We've learned from our ancestors, never again for anyone. And Sam Eilertson is apparently the individual who took that video. He said, here's my video. For a second, I thought I was filming the next Heather Heyer video, moment. It was absolutely shocking and horrifying, and I'm a bit shaken up. Fortunately, it appears no one was seriously hurt. And according to the group afterward, some of the ICE guards afterward came up, pepper sprayed the group. Police were nearby, they did nothing. And that is not surprising. I mean, we talked to Andy Z earlier this week about how the LAPD infiltrated his own anti-fascist group. We can see, unfortunately, I can't speak for all individuals in the police force, but we know where their loyalties lie, unfortunately, in cases like this. And so what you saw there was, it's not like, even if you remove all of the context, it would be absolutely horrific. That guard made the decision that, I don't know for sure if anyone is going to die, but I'm willing to kill someone to get my truck in there. Because there's a multiple people in front of there. One of them easily could have gone down and he could have run them over. And he just decided, hey, you can't make some omelets, you know? If I have to kill a person, I'll do that. But when you add in the context, it's obviously far worse. Like, we know who runs down individuals, who runs down either peaceful civilians or protesters. There's a generally ISIS or Al-Qaeda affiliated terrorists generally in Europe, but it's happened in Canada as well. Decide, you know what, I'm just gonna use my truck and I'm gonna mow down a bunch of people. And there's American Nazis who, when they don't like what a protester stands for, they murder them with their truck. And this ICE guard decided, I am going to be a part of that noble tradition of using my vehicle as a weapon. These people who are exercising their constitutional rights, they're acting in the utmost fashion of an American, a patriotic American who cares about what's going on in our country and is going to peacefully protest to make sure that people pay attention to it. I'm going to risk murdering them because I want to get my truck through. That's what I'm going to do. And the police decided, hey, who can be bothered? Not gonna get involved in this. Is this really my business? If he kills somebody, he kills somebody. I'm just gonna let it happen. Now, I wanna give you more information about this group because they're doing great work, as you can see, at risk of their own lives. Never Again Action calls on Jewish people to shut down ICE facilities. It's led largely by young people. It aims to illustrate that the problem is not only hundreds or thousands of miles away, but also at the many detention centers spread throughout the US. Since its initial protest in New Jersey less than a week ago, this is now several weeks ago actually, Never Again Action has organized over 20 actions around the country. I think that's up towards 30 now. So this is an organization that came about as a result of the conversation that was going on mainly on social media about the development of these concentration camps and people understanding the historic precedent in other countries for what's going on here. And they decided that they're actually going to learn from history. They're not going to allow it to be repeated. They're going to step up and try to stop it. And that's what they've been doing ever since. But I added a little bit of context earlier, I wanna add some more context. What you saw there might seem like an isolated incident. One ICE guard decides, I don't care about these people's lives, I'm going to risk killing them. But it's actually sort of the culmination of one aspect of conservative thought about protests that we've seen play out throughout the country for the past few years. Back in 2017, it became a thing. It was sort of the trend that Republicans would attempt to legally protect people who run over protesters. That may sound crazy. It might sound like it's coming direct from the Onion, but it's true. Back in 2017, Republican lawmakers in at least six states proposed bills designed to protect drivers who strike protesters. The first bill was introduced in North Dakota in January, and similar bills have since come under consideration in North Carolina, Tennessee, Florida, Texas, and Rhode Island. So we're talking about like a pretty significant chunk of America had politicians who were saying, if you run down protesters, what can we do about it? We're gonna go out of our way, in fact, to make sure that there are no legal consequences, either civil or criminal, if you do that. So in five of the six states where the bills were introduced, the legislation would shield drivers who hit protesters or demonstrators only. We're gonna return to that in just a second. Drivers who kill pedestrians who are not out exercising their First Amendment rights would still be subject to the usual criminal and civil liabilities. In other words, the purpose of these proposals was to make acts of protest and acts of protest alone more lethal. So think about that. They're saying that obviously they can't allow you to just run down anyone. That's crazy. That's Death Race 2000. We're not there yet. That's what Eric Trump will be running on in 8 years. So what they're saying is if you're there and you're struck because you're exercising your constitutional rights, you actually perversely have less rights than a random person on the street. So if I'm just randomly walking across the street because I wanna get to a Starbucks and someone hits me, I should be protected, which makes sense. But if I'm there because I'm protesting against Starbucks corporate policies or whatever, my rights have now been stripped away from me. So if I exercise my rights, I lose my rights. Isn't that amazing how they've worked that out? And that was a big thing, as we said, six different bills. Now, let's talk about the sort of movement because, you know, sometimes things just happen and there's no coordination between them. But the original versions of the bills in Tennessee, Rhode Island, and North Carolina, all of which were introduced in just a 2 month period, were strikingly similar, even down to the language used, making it seem that although we can't prove this, that there was a coordinated effort from someone to push these bills in multiple state legislatures. And it's important to note that all of the aforementioned bills were introduced by Republicans, but in Rhode Island, it actually had two Democratic co-sponsors. So it is sick enough that one party has gotten behind stripping people of their rights because they dare to organize. But the idea that Democrats would also sign on to it, even if just in one state, is disgusting as well. Also, and we're running out of time, unfortunately, but it goes beyond just Republican legislatures trying to make it perfectly fine to kill these people. There's also right-wing pundits who think that, hey, again, omelets, eggs, you put it together. Fox News at one point and the Daily Caller both had to delete posts encouraging people to drive through protests. And in the Daily Caller's case, what they were sharing was a video that's since been taken off of YouTube. Gleefully, it's a mashup of people driving through protests and trying to run people down. It's the Daily Caller, legitimate right-wing media source encouraging people to murder their political opponents if they dare to stand in the way of their vehicle. So that's sick. It's sick whether it's in the case of this ICE demonstrator, whether it's Republican politicians or right-wing media, all of whom have decided that for all that they love to talk about the Constitution and your rights, you don't agree with them politically. If you stand against things like these detention centers or if you're a Black Lives Matter protester, your rights are out the door and your life might be as well. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, lots more show to get to.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today, and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Primaries around the country are getting more and more interested as good progressives and people from around the country decide to run for the first time and challenge some of the people who've been holding these offices for quite a while. We want to talk to a candidate now. This is a candidate for the 9th District in New York. Isaiah James, welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. So you've launched a primary challenge against, Yvette Clark, who's held the position for 10 years. And I believe you haven't held elected office previously, is that correct?
No, I have not.
So what made you want to get involved now, running for this 2020 race?
Well, as a part of my activism work that I do, I have actually met with Congresswoman Clark on a number of occasions about some of the key issues like Medicare for All, the Green New Deal, and specifically with the Amazon deal that was going down here in New York a few months ago. And I sat across the table from her and challenged her on a lot of these issues, and she lied right to my face as a constituent. And I came home that night and I told my wife, and she was like, "Well, why don't you run? Why don't you do it?" And I was like, "You know what? You're right. Why don't I stop talking about it and why don't I be about it?"
So tell me about these lies. So you brought up some of the biggest, most important issues right now. And did she falsely imply to you that she was working on those issues, or how was she deceptive in that way?
Well, specifically with the Amazon deal, there's a notorious letter going around New York City from all the elected officials at the time that signed the letter urging Amazon to move to New York City. Mm-hmm. And I challenged Congresswoman Clark on that, and she looked me directly in my face and said she never signed that letter. And it's been printed in multiple news outlets that she signed it. So either she didn't value my intelligence as a constituent, or she doesn't know what she's signing. Yeah. Either way, that's bad for a congressional representative.
Yeah, and I can understand why that would have gotten under your skin. And now you're running against her. I want to get into your platform in just a second, but I mean, you brought up Amazon, obviously. There's the corporate influence is heavy in some of these elections. So let's talk about campaign finance. Let's talk about what's your philosophy, what money are you working to raise, what money will you not accept, and what's Yvette Clark's strategy been so far?
Well, I believe we should have publicly funded elections, point blank, period. Congresswoman Clark's donor list reads like a Fortune 500 company donor list. every major corporation. When I say some of the worst corporations, I'm talking Bank of America, BlackRock, you know, the huge pharmaceutical companies, the huge insurance companies. And yes, she claims to be a progressive. You cannot take money from these people and give them a seat at the table and then claim to be a progressive and claim to actually care about hardworking people. In my campaign, I will not take one dime from any major corporation, corporate PAC, anything like that. I've already told everybody who's been involved in this campaign that this is a campaign about principles. This is a campaign about doing what's right and about changing the conversation about what's politically possible in this country. And we cannot keep going down the same road, courting corporations and expect a different outcome.
Yeah, and it looks like in terms of the money that's being donated to her, people have sort of gotten this message, because according to our research, less than 1% of her donations come from individual contributions, 88% from PACs, which is not really representative in any fashion other than representative of corporations that might operate in that district. So let's say that you beat her. What sort of difference will that make for individuals in your district? What are some of your priorities going to be if you hold that office?
Well, the first thing that I would say would be a top priority would be affordable housing. Mm-hmm. Because if anybody's familiar with New York and specifically the 9th Congressional District, affordable housing is non-existent in my district. So one of my plans is to build a federal community land trust program so low-income people can actually own the land in which these homes are built. Another thing is to have a federally backed program. Like, I'm a veteran, so veterans get GI Bill and guaranteed home loans. We need a system like that, or a program like that, federally funded, for people making between $50,000 and $80,000 a year to get them out of renter status into home ownership. Mm-hmm. Those are some of the big, bold solutions that I'm proposing that Congresswoman Clark isn't even talking about. When we say change the conversation, we truly mean like these things aren't even being brought up on the national stage. And in my opinion, a congressional representative is the biggest advocate for their constituents. The fact that I go to these NYCHA projects every single day to talk to voters and constituents, and they haven't even seen our congressional representative, is part of the problem.
Can you tell us a little bit about the district?
Yes, this district is very eclectic. There is a huge, huge Caribbean population. There's a huge Jewish population. We have two colleges in the district, my alma mater, Brooklyn College, and Medgar Evers College, which are both city schools. So there are a lot of young progressives in this district. The DSA has one of the largest branches in New York City, mm-hmm. in Central Brooklyn, in my district. This is actually Shirley Chisholm's old congressional seat. This is Anthony Weiner's old congressional seat. So it's a very storied seat. And Shirley Chisholm's motto was unbought and unbossed. And I don't know if Congresswoman Clark is bossed, but she is 100% bought and paid for.
I do like that motto. I'm not sure what Anthony Weiner's motto was. I can speculate, but I'm not going to live on air. But hopefully you can return to the previous sort of philosophy of holding that seat.
Absolutely.
What's interesting is that we know that the Democratic leadership is not a fan of these sorts of primary challenges. So far, have you had any interaction with the DNC or the DCCC or any of these other organizations?
No, but on the city level, there have been people telling me to drop out. The last candidate she faced told me to drop out in no uncertain terms. Mm-hmm. In New York City, challenging the establishment is a huge no-no. But we cannot wait. The issues that we're facing, we cannot wait to address these issues. And we cannot have corporate Democrats and centrists who want incrementalism. I mean, if you believe the UN climate report, we have 11 years before everything hits the fan. I don't even know if I want to have children. Me and my wife talk about it all the time. Do we want to bring a child into the world where income inequality is rampant, or white supremacy is on the rise, where our climate is being destroyed by fossil fuel companies? I mean, these are basic issues of fairness and equality that somebody needs to fight for. Yeah. And that's why I got in this race.
Yeah, those are difficult considerations that I'm sure a lot of potential parents are probably thinking about. It's terrible that you have to go through all that pressure being put against you to run. But we also know that for that sort of movement where you had AOC, as you say, the DSA quite strong in that area. And so hopefully these sorts of organizations and some of the prior successful primaries will be helpful in you getting elected as well.
That would be very, very nice.
Isaiah James, thank you so much for joining us and good luck with your candidacy.
Thank you.
We're gonna take a short break here. We come back, gonna put a little bit of pressure on Donald Trump. We've been trying all week to get him to take the plight of animals seriously. Now we're turning to the trees. Because the Democrats have apparently decided that they're not gonna be pushing for impeachment of Donald Trump. If we're going to get any action to deal with the climate crisis, it's probably going to have to go through Donald Trump. It's a difficult task, but we've been engaging in it here at the Damage Report all this week. We've been trying to get put pressure on Trump to stop fearing and demonizing animals so much. But now we turn to a different aspect of nature, and that is trees, which are, according to scientists, a really important part of dealing with climate change. And this is an area where Donald Trump, he's a guy who's not very curious. He doesn't seem to have many hobbies. He does seem to be interested in one thing though, and that is forest management. He's tweeted about it quite often. He said previously, billions of dollars are sent to the state of California for forest fires that with proper forest management would never happen unless they get their act together, which is unlikely. I've ordered FEMA to send no more money. And so the money is dependent on them caring about forest management, which they don't care about as much as he does. But he's done it again in November, saying that there's costly forest fires, we need better forest management. And then also with proper forest management, we can stop the devastation. To get Donald Trump to tweet three times about an aspect of caring for nature is certainly noteworthy. And so Donald Trump, tree aficionado, wait until you get a load of what trees can do. A group of researchers associated with the Crowther Lab in Switzerland found that global tree restoration is, quote, our most effective climate change solution to date. These trees that they advocate to be planted would store 205 billion tons of carbon, or roughly 2/3 of the carbon that's been emitted as a result of human activity since the Industrial Revolution. So effectively, if across the entirety of the globe, we were to plant trees roughly spanning the area of the continental United States, we could reduce significantly all of the carbon that we have emitted since the Industrial Revolution. And for a conservative like Donald Trump, this has got to be really appealing, both because they say that they like conservation and all of that. There's obviously like the stewardship of the planet implied in things like the Bible. But also, if you're worried about expensive carbon capture technology or any sort of regulations that could harm the economy, I don't actually buy that, but they seem to, then this is a great alternative. Rather than all those regulations, we can just plant a lot of trees. Wouldn't that be awesome? And it turns out that internationally, there have been some countries taking this very seriously. In 2017, India set the world record when around 1.5 million volunteers planted 66 million trees in just 12 hours, which sounds impossible, right? Half a day, 66 million trees. But it turns out that that global record wouldn't stand for very long. Just a couple of weeks ago, Ethiopia planted more than 353 million trees in just 12 hours. The new world record. That burst of tree planting was part of a wider reforestation campaign named Green Legacy, which is a cool name for it. Perhaps could be a part of the Green New Deal. This shirt, by the way, is available at ShopTYT. And we take it seriously, and other countries are too. If India and Ethiopia can do it, it begs the question, why can't everybody do it? Why can't we do it? But that record that they broke, as impressive as that is, they have their sights set far broader than just that. Ethiopia has the goal for the whole season to plant 4 billion trees during the rainy season. That's just May to October, and they seem to be off to a great start when it comes to that, honestly. Now, the thing is, that's a huge number of trees, but the numbers that scientists are saying we need to plant, something like a trillion trees, is obviously much more. 353 is a huge, it's a titanic number of trees, but you need many, many times that. And at the end of the day, it's going to be difficult for human labor exclusively to actually plant these many trees, for you to dig and plant a seed and all of that, not to mention the maintenance. That's a lot of labor. So why not involve a little bit of technology? And it turns out there's a number of companies that have been working to make this goal much easier to achieve. We're gonna talk about one company in particular. Understand they're not a sponsor of the Young Turks. I have no vested interest in this company. I use them only as an example of this sort of technology. But let's talk about the drones from startup Biocarbon Engineering. They can plant as many as 100,000 trees in a single day. The drone technology works in stages. As a first step, mapping drones, these are fixed wing drones, fly more than 300 feet over the land, collecting detailed data about the topography and soil quality. An algorithm uses that data to choose the best locations to plant trees and the best species to plant. Next, they deploy a second group of drones, like a swarm of drones flying low over the ground. They automatically follow the map that's been generated to plant seeds in custom nutrient-filled seed pods designed by plant scientists to support each species. Each drone can carry a mix of different species simultaneously. It follows the map, so it's like effectively artificial intelligence led, and it fires the pods into the ground quickly enough to penetrate the soil. And so here you have plants that are not just like trees that are not just being planted in mass, but intelligently to make sure that as many take root as possible. And so that will increase your yield in the long run. A lot of this can, of course, be automated. Drones can move, they can cover one section, then the next day they move to another. And then they can leave the more labor intensive caring for the trees while they're young to the humans who will follow afterward. Now that is great. Those drones, there's a lot of companies that are working in this area, and I'm sure nonprofits are going to be affiliating with some of these companies to hit the goals that they need to hit. But you need to understand that while that's sort of the good news, there's bad news too. Sure, India and Ethiopia and other countries are doing amazing work, you know, powered by people to plant these trees, and the technology is coming up fast as well. But in other parts of the world, we're moving in the exact opposite direction. In the month of July, the Amazon lost 519 square miles of rainforest. That's an area more than twice the size of Tokyo. And again, that's just one month. It's the month that just ended, unfortunately. It's pretty bad. Hopefully August won't be worse, although at this point we don't yet know. But so you have like millions of trees being planted in one part of the world. At the same time, they are stripping as many trees as possible for agriculture and things like that. Data from Brazilian satellites in particular indicate that about 3 football fields worth of Amazonian trees are falling every single minute. The total area of deforestation is up 39% from July of last year. And so those are the sorts of numbers, those are the sorts of statistics that you might sort of have some vague memories of from back in like the 90s, right? When there was this international effort to deal with deforestation and the loss of the Amazon. It was this international focus, at least for a limited time. And indeed, there was some success. There was a period where deforestation was starting to dip, but now it's going up again. Bolsonaro taking over in Brazil, he is throwing gasoline on the fire, but it was getting bad even before Bolsonaro. And the drive to exploit more and more of the Amazon for commercial interests, there's some mining, it's mainly agriculture, that has been proceeding really horribly. Now, the issue is not just the amount that's being taken away, it's that there's a threshold where if you lose a certain amount of the Amazon, and we focus on this because it's considered like the lungs of the planet, it's the most important part in terms of canopy cover in one area of the world. Take a look at this number. If in the past 50 years we've lost about 20% of the Amazon, that's 300,000 square miles, which is just absurd. If another 20% of the Amazon were to disappear, it could trigger a feedback loop known as a dieback, in which the forest dries out and burns. Once this dieback starts, the forest would be, quote, beyond the reach of any subsequent human intervention or regret. The Amazon could devolve into a savanna-like landscape. And so we're already halfway there in just the past few decades. If the same amount is lost, according to scientists, it could trigger a cascade that will result in all of the Amazon being destroyed. I probably don't need to tell you that the Amazon is an incredibly unique area of the world, important not just for different elements of biodiversity, but also for storing carbon as well. If that were to die, it would be utterly tragic in every way that a situation like this could be tragic. And it is an example of the forces that we're fighting against, not just in maintaining the tree cover, the canopy that we have now, but hopefully working towards this goal that scientists have set to plant a trillion trees to make averting some of the worst impacts of climate change possible. We have to move in the right direction, both in terms of our own will as people, a political pressure on our governments, as well as technology to plant as many trees as possible. But we also need to put international pressure on the corporations in areas like Brazil and other aspects, other areas of the Amazon that are working to clear away at a monumental rate the trees that we already have. So you have deforestation, you have reforestation. These are two different paths that our world could take. It's going to be up to us which it is that we walk. Okay, we're going to take a short break here. When we come back, more on the climate crisis with two awesome guests after this. So today on the show, we identified some of the corporate enemies of those who want to do something about the climate crisis we're in. But thankfully, there are some people working against them as well. People we can trust. And we're joined now by two, actually. James Cromwell, Academy Award nominated actor and activist, and Pramila Malik, environmental activist, community organizer, and 2018 Democratic State Senate candidate. Both James and Pramila served a 2017 jail sentence for climate disobedience. So thank you for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
I've talked with both of you before. Unfortunately, we haven't solved the climate crisis yet. The struggle continues to make it a big part of this election. And I know that both of you want to put pressure on politicians to do what's necessary. So what form should that pressure come in? What needs to be done?
Take that?
No.
I mean, well, first of all, I think on your show last time I talked about climate truth being the crack between climate denial and climate deception. Mm-hmm. And we have to understand that we have, on the right, we have climate denial, but on the left, we have climate deception. And New York State really serves as a cautionary tale because we have a Democratic governor, we have a Democratic legislature, so 100% under Democratic control, but we have policies that are worsening the climate crisis. We have two major frack gas power plants under development right now mm-hmm. in New York State. So we have to hold all of our elected officials accountable, and we have to crack through the deception. You want to add to that?
Yeah, I don't. I actually don't know. We have to organize. We have to be behind. We have to ask of candidates that they take a principled stand, that they come out on this issue of fracking is principally responsible for the rise in CO2 and greenhouse gases. It's not enough for somebody to come within 2 or 3 months of running for president of the United States to mm-hmm. express their position. We want people who've had a long standing when this was first presented to the people, when we understood what was at stake, which was in 2016, those people who took a stand right then, Bernie being one of them. And they have to have a comprehensive plan, first of all, that covers the entirety of the issue, which is complex, but they also have to be able to explain that to people.
Yes.
The electorate has to become informed. We have to have a debate. The fact that the DNC is not allowing a climate a debate as part of the run-up to the primary is indicative of a institution, the Democratic Party, which is under the control of the oil and gas industry, in the sense that they provide the bulk of the money. So any issue that they want, there are, of course, pharmaceuticals and many other interested parties corrupting this process. The process itself now is corrupt. So we can, Bernie asked for a revolution. It may have to be a revolution in the sense that all the institutions of government are failing either through corruption or incompetence. And we are asking our elected leaders to address an issue that has an absolute end date. There will come a point in which there is no return. And if they do not address that, and if they do not find a way around the intransigence, both of the legislature and the institutions that are supposed to be addressing this, it will continue to the point in which survival is impossible on this planet.
Pramila, I wanted to ask you sort of the combination of a few of the things we've been talking about. New York's sort of shaky commitment to this issue and the presidential race as well. So you had an interaction with Bill de Blasio and you were talking about these plants. Has there been any follow-up from that? First of all, if you could tell our viewers about what happened, but also has he followed up his views on the development of these plants?
No, I mean, again, you know, this is the bipartisan corruption that, you know, I talk about all the time. Bill de Blasio is the mayor of New York City. The power plant that we were arrested for obstructing is built and is operational right now to serve New York City. He's the mayor of New York City. He should take a position on it. He should use his voice. He should reject that allowing New York City to be locked into frack gas dependency for the next 40 years. And, you know, when we talk about New York City, we're talking about the second largest consumer of power in the entire world. Mm-hmm. And there was a new study, a scientific study just out yesterday by Cornell University's climate scientist Robert Howarth, that has identified methane means fracking, as the single biggest culprit causing the climate crisis today. In the last decade, we've seen huge spikes in methane emissions since 2008, since fracking began in the United States. And two-thirds of global methane emissions now is being attributed to fracking in United States and Canada, North America. So, you know, 2008 to now, that's all Obama. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a Democratic president, and that was during a Democratic administration. So, you know, Joe Biden is very much a derivative of that same policy. We have, you know, Jay Inslee, who's supposed to be the Democratic Party's climate candidate. Up until he decided he was running for office, he was supporting two fracked gas projects in his state, a methanol plant and an LNG port. Cataclysmic for the climate. So what we're saying is, look at the candidate's record, not their rhetoric. And we're also saying that we need to look at candidates that are outside of the political establishment of both parties. And I don't mean Green Party here. I mean, again, you know, I'm not disparaging the Green Party. Jamie's a Green Party member. But what I'm saying is, there are two in this, of all the Democratic candidates right now, there are only two that have from the beginning taken a principled, scientifically informed position on climate change. That is Bernie Sanders and Tulsi Gabbard. And the issue of fracking, that was the central issue of the 2016 campaign. That is why Bernie delegates supported Bernie Sanders, is because he took a position on fracking, supporting a ban on fracking, and also because of his position on TPP. And those were the two issues that were deal breakers with the Bernie delegates in 2016. I was at the platform committee meeting in Florida in 2016 when there was supposed to be a vote to support a ban on fracking. And the two sides were supposed to come together to establish a joint platform. When I saw the kind of games that the party leaders deployed to thwart even a vote on fracking, that's when I realized that the party itself is completely broken and compromised. And, you know, when you look at our battle with this power plant company, the father of the executive that was just convicted of bribing Governor Cuomo's aide, he is very much entrenched with the Democratic Party. That's Peter Kelly. He was chair of fundraising and finance for many, many years. He was political advisor to Al Gore, political advisor to Bill Clinton. And so you see, again, this, you know, bipartisan corruption. And we have to, again, that's why I'm encouraging people to look outside of the establishment. We have candidates now who are suddenly taking a position on fracking. Cory Booker apparently has now supported a ban on fracking.
Did he? I actually had not heard that.
Yeah, that's what morning. I just now. But, you know, but his state, he represents New Jersey. They also built a power plant by the same company that we are fighting in New Jersey, once again built to serve New York City. So where was he on that issue then? Where was Senator Gillibrand on when this power plant was being developed? I mean, we reached out to her in 2011. Frontline communities like ours were screaming from the rooftops in 2011 saying methane is cooking our communities and cooking the planet. We have, you know, frontline communities, they know that methane is leaking because we live next to it. We can smell the leaking methane. We can feel the leaking methane. You know, we see the ozone impacting our communities. So, you know, they didn't listen to us back then. And imagine, had they listened to us in 2011, we would be in a very different place in terms of fighting climate change than we are today. And the news is just worse every single day. The climate news is worse. And there's a new study out coming from Canada that really says we don't have 12 years, we have 18 months, which is why we think the 2020 election is going to be the defining moment for the fight against climate change.
Well, on that, I certainly could not agree more. And hopefully it will be not only a big part of the conversation inside of the Democratic primary, and we'll get more hard commitments like what you were implying, which I, like I said, I just found out about for Cory Booker, but also making sure that no matter what happens, that our government is going to move in the right direction. And that's why I appreciate the advocacy of both of you on this issue. And thank you so much for taking time out to join us on the show today.
Thank you so much for having us.
We're gonna take one last break here. We come back, workers' rights, disrespect against workers on display in a recent Ben Shapiro clip, but Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez responds. We'll have both for you after this. I want to turn now to a recent Ben Shapiro clip. I don't often cover him because it's terrible and I hate to inflict his voice on you, but recently, Ben Shapiro decided to once again attack American workers, disrespecting them, and implying that any issue that they have economically is totally on them, not on the system that we have set up or allowed to be set up. And we're going to have AOC's response. That's why she's next to me, and I really didn't want to put Ben Shapiro's picture there. So we're going to play the video, and then she'll respond after this.
Well, the fact is that if you had to work more than one job to have a roof over your head or food on the table, you probably shouldn't have taken the job that's not paying you enough. That'd be a you problem. Also, it is not true that the vast majority of people in the United States are working two jobs. It just is not true. According to the census statistics, a small but steady number of American workers have more than one job because either they need extra income or because they want to gain more experience or explore different interests. There's a recently released U.S. Census Bureau report, and apparently what it found is that approximately 8.3%, this is as of 2013, so it's actually lower now, 8.3% of workers had more than one job.
Okay, it is astounding to me that anyone can listen to more than 35 or so seconds of that. Just the body language, the lack of ability to have eye contact with the camera is just insane. It's disrespectful to the audience. Anyway, we're gonna move past that and we're gonna talk about the content of what he said, because he said, if you have more than one job, that's on you. Why did you take a job that couldn't pay everything that you need in just one job? Why would anyone work more than one job? And then he goes on to say, and it's not even a real issue anyway, because it's only a few percentage points of the American public. It's not loads and loads of people. Now, here's the thing. His fans love to say he's just being honest. He likes stats. He likes facts. And so it's weird that he went out of his way there to not tell you how many Americans this actually affects. He sort of cloaked it in statistics, making it seem as if it's not a lot of people. But the thing is, I actually found the article that he was talking about. And the title of it is, about 13 million US workers have more than one job. I would classify, and I think it's fair to classify that as loads and loads of people. I'm really not that interested in what percentage of the American public it is. It's literally millions and millions and millions of people. And thus, I think it's worthy of our consideration about what is actually going on. Why do they have to have more than one job? I'm gonna return to that and how little ground he has to stand on in criticizing those sorts of people. But first, I do wanna turn to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I'm torn here because I don't want her to waste any of her time on him, but I do like that she continues to stand up for the American working class. And so she did that in this case, saying, one of the most manipulative tactics plutocrats use is convincing people that the systemic issues we face are a character flaw instead of policy flaws. Working people aren't dumb or inferior, nor are they why insulin costs $300 or huge corporations pay starvation wages. Corruption is, and she's 100% right there. One of the biggest myths that the right has been pushing since the beginning of America, you know, it goes back before that, but for the American context, that's what matters, is that if there's anything wrong in your life, it's just on you. Don't look to the government. Certainly don't look behind the curtain. Don't look at who got those politicians into power. Don't look at who's writing the laws. Don't look at who's manipulating the system to get us into the situation we're in right now. It's all on you. Hate yourself, American working class, and leave us to become ever wealthier. That is the grift, and that is what Ben Shapiro is there for. His career was created out of whole cloth by millionaires and billionaires to advance their economic interests. That's the only reason that he exists at all, and he continues to push that sort of message here. Now, in particular, he's attacking people who have the gall to have more than one job. Now, the thing is, Ben Shapiro has less call to criticize those sorts of people than literally anyone else in this country. He's never had a real job. It's unlikely that he's ever known a person that worked a minimum wage position. Now, I've had a relatively easy life, but I just randomly went back through my experience that I've worked from the age of 14 as a busboy, a worker in a toy store, a manager at a toy store, a caterer, a waiter at multiple restaurants in multiple states across the US, a bartender, a barista, a sandwich maker, a lab attendant, a tutor, a TA, and whatever it is this career that I have now is. So if you are going to criticize the American working class, at least have once dipped your toe in the American working class and understand that people don't take those jobs because it's fun. And oh no, now I'm in it. I can't afford to pay my rent. They had to take those jobs because the political system and the economic system have been doing everything they can for literally decades to keep wages as low as they currently are. More to come. That's all the time we have, unfortunately. Thank you for watching. We'll close out the week with you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.